Hi, I'm the world's saddest masturbation scene, Taylor.
And I'm lesbian WandaVision for sickos, Jemmy. And this is the Final Girl Files. This week we watched 2001's Mulholland Drive, directed by David Lynch, starring Naomi Watts, Laura Herring, Justin Theroux, Ann Miller, Mark Pellegrino, and Robert Forster. And oh boy, it's a David Lynch movie.
Yeah, it is.
That's for sure.
I have never seen this movie.
Neither have I. Although, children, I'm going to regale you. This is a story about believing in yourself. So
we have a true story about faith, trust, and pixie dust coming your way.
Absolutely. Also, the dinging of Taylor's iPhone.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. So, I, like, not to get too hashtag personal, but I had a little bit of a breakdown watching this movie because, like, so the TV in my room is set up, like, surrounded by all my, like, Marvel Funko Pops, and I had a bit of, like, a moment where I was like, oh no, I don't understand this David Lynch movie. Has Marvel movies just rotted my brain, and am I, like, stupid and basic now? And it was a whole thing. It wasn't fun in the moment, but I'm looking back at it now about 2 hours later and laughing, because I, unbeknownst to myself, had already figured out, like, what was happening in this movie. Like, I was not all the way there, but my interpretation was pretty much right. And, so this is a lesson, children. Always believe what your gut tells you.
Because sometimes you're right about movies.
Sometimes you're right about movies. It's almost like I spent 4 years of my life studying them. Anyway.
That film degree? Not useless. You knew what David Lynch was trying to say.
And he was trying to say in about 20 odd years, they will make a Marvel TV show that is just a wholesome version of this.
He was trying to say that sometimes being a gay woman's kind of weird.
Damn, Taylor, it sure is.
I actually don't think he was saying anything in particular about gay women specifically. Although some people do take that interpretation. I don't.
I mean, I am a gay woman, and sometimes my life is a little weird, so this resonates with me.
Weird gay women, stand up. This is a movie for you.
Are there any normal gay women? Let's be real.
I had never seen
Ellen,
this movie.
Ellen was a normal gay woman, and that's why she was like that.
True.
Okay, let's get into the plot so we're not just sitting here making stupid jokes. Although we will be doing that for the rest of the episode.
Yes.
Don't worry. Blonde Betty Elms has only just arrived in Hollywood to become a movie star when she meets an animatic brunette with amnesia. Meanwhile, as the two set off to solve the second woman's identity, filmmaker Adam Kesher runs into ominous trouble while casting his latest project. And, like most of the movies that we have covered for the past couple of weeks, that's kind of the plot.
But that's only the beginning.
On a very basic level, like not even scratching beneath the surface of what's happening there. There's a lot happening in this movie.
I have some behind the scenes info that will make this movie make a little more sense also.
Please.
So picture this. It's the early 2000s, right? It's like it's literally the year 2000.
Uh-huh.
Twin Peaks was so successful in the 90s, and everyone loved it. And everyone was scratching their heads going, what is the solution of the mystery in Twin Peaks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's TV everyone's talking about. So David Lynch decides, I'm going to make another TV show that's like a mystery. He wrote a pilot for a show called Mulholland Drive, which was about an aspiring actress who comes to Hollywood and meets a woman with amnesia, and together they embark on the mystery of trying to solve her identity and what happened to make her get amnesia. And then some gay stuff happens, and then the network was like, this is the worst pilot we've ever seen, we're not making it. So David Lynch decides, okay, fair, I'm going to add some stuff to it and make it a movie. And so he wrote the last, like, half hour with the box and all of that. And then we got Mulholland Drive.
And ladies and gentlemen, we call that king shit.
So originally, when this was supposed to be a television show, it was just going to be the beginning part.
Huh.
So it was not conceptualized as being as trippy as it ended up being when it became a film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all the stuff in the ending of the film and, like, the kind of pull out to reveal, because, spoiler alert, basically everything that happens in this movie is probably a dream or a fantasy of Naomi Watts' character.
Yeah. Yep.
All of that stuff was not... It was not originally envisioned as such. It was supposed to be just like a straightforward. The plot was the beginning bit.
That's really wild to me, actually, because in going back, because I did watch, I did join the legions of people on Letterboxd who had to be like, who had to like pull up YouTube after they were done with this movie, like Mulholland Drive explained. But there's so much of this movie, like all the little details in the dream that really it's so intertwined and so like well tied together that it's a little wild to me that like one was conceived without the other. And I think it's definitely a hallmark of like David Lynch's ability to write, like, hell yeah, dude.
Yeah. And he even said later, like, I saw some, you know, David Lynch is notoriously cagey about this and all of his movies. Like he's like a self-enforced death of the author. He refuses to talk about what his movies mean. Listen, which I love for him, by the way. I think more directors should do this.
I was just gonna say, he is a real one for that.
Yeah, like, if, like, in any interview where people are like, what does Mulholland Drive mean? What is the meaning of Mulholland? He's like, I'm not telling you. He's like, figure it out. And I love it, but that's beside the point. In interviews when he's talking about the, like, the actual creative process of making the movie, not, like, what it means, because he refuses to talk about that part, but he'll talk about what it was like to make the film. He says, like, you know, once I wrote the second bit of it, it all clicked into place, and it was like it was always meant to be this, but I just didn't know yet, which is very interesting to me, because, like, yeah, it does feel like it was written all at once. Like, I was shocked to find out that he had not originally imagined it to be the, like, weird, trippy, alternate reality version of this other thing.
Right, exactly. Because, and I think, too, like, the dream sequences, or the part of the movie that is in the dream, dream sequence isn't a good thing to say, but in the dream world, it's so stylized and so, like, vague unreality.
And yeah, Naomi Watts' acting in the beginning was very off-putting for me. Because she plays it like, and I've seen Naomi Watts in other stuff. I know she's a very good actress. So it was very bizarre because her acting is, like, not good in the beginning. And then you watch the ending and you're like, oh, it's on purpose.
Yep. See, when I approached this movie, like, I knew it was going to be a David Lynch movie. And I think this is part of kind of why I was a little, like, off-put by this movie. Like, I knew it was going to be a David Lynch movie, and so I wasn't sure what level of surreality I should prepare myself for. Because I've seen surreal movies before. Like, I am a film student, capital F, film, capital S, student. Like, I know what watching movies like that is like. And I was simultaneously expecting something more difficult to follow and also less weird. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because this movie has, like, a reputation as being borderline incoherent, which I don't think is entirely undeserved, but I think can be, like, overblown. And I think it can kind of be a roadblock to watching and enjoying the movie.
I will say this, I am not, like, listen, I'm autistic. Following plots is fine for me when it's, like, normal plots. I followed this okay. Like, I like to think I followed this okay.
I don't think it's super hard to follow.
No.
Once you, like, kind of wrap your head around what it's trying to do, it makes a lot more sense. Like, I understand if you're completely going in blind and you also have, like, no outlet to discuss the movie. Like, it can feel like, well, what the fuck was that?
this is like probably the only movie in the world where I'd be like, if you don't get it, like look up the ending explained stuff and like you will come away with a new appreciation for this movie, because that's what happened to me.
Yeah. I think its reputation as being sort of incoherent is, like I said, not entirely undeserved, but also like a little overblown.
I have seen movies that are vastly more incoherent than this one.
Yeah, like I kind of went into this movie expecting it to be more like unable to be understood and followed more than it actually was. And again, like I said, I think that a movie having a reputation like that can kind of ironically make it harder for you to wrap your head around the movie.
Mm-hmm. That's what happened to me.
Because when you're going into a movie like this thinking to yourself, like, oh, it's going to be so weird and crazy and I'm not going to be able to understand it, like, your brain then doesn't want to pick up the clues that David Lynch sets out for you to pick up.
That is exactly what happened to me, like, to the letter.
Yeah. So, like, I'm very curious as to, like, what your initial feelings on the, like, on the plot were before you kind of dove into it via reading about it and watching videos and trying to like understand it. I know that you said that you had basically gotten it, but I'm interested to see like what the like the differing things were.
I mean, I didn't really pick a lot of the little details until they were pointed out to me, but I did get the general like gist of like, oh, this is like reality and fantasy, the dichotomy is there, and this, you know, one informs the other. Also, I do have to say, I've mentioned on this podcast before, I am extremely face blind. This movie was torture for me.
Oh no. When she put on that wig, that must have been like,
listen, I have a note. Yeah, I have a note here that just says, oh no, now they have the same haircut. Oh, I was very relieved when they said it was a wig and she took it off, and I was like, oh, thank God. Now I can
tell. You're like, okay, she's not going to be wearing it for the rest of the movie.
But, like, the thing that actually got me was, like, Diane's hair is, like, slightly different from Betty's. And I was, that, and it was enough to, like, throw me off for a minute. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. Because I thought Diane, like, when we went into the real world with Diane, I thought it was the waitress that we saw earlier, because this hair is similar, and it was not a good time for me and my face blind ass.
Well, the waitress's name is also Diane.
Yeah.
And then when they switch to the real world, the waitress that they meet at the diner's name is Betty, so.
Yeah. Yeah, it tripped me up for a minute. Then, like, because I had to, like, pull up the Wikipedia page several times for this watching this movie.
Oh, so did I.
Just to follow along. I should have, in hindsight, I really should have just read the whole thing and not, like, cared about spoilers, because I think that would have improved my experience watching this movie.
Yeah, if you had gone in knowing kind of what was going to happen.
Yeah, I shouldn't have cared about spoilers.
That's basically what I did, and I think it helped me a lot. Like, towards the beginning of the movie, I, like, pulled up the Wikipedia article and just, like, read it.
You were so valid for that. You were smarter than me.
The thing is that I'm not. I probably would have had the same reaction as you did if I hadn't, like, had my phone out the entire movie.
I know, I'm saying that you were smart to have your phone out the entire movie, because I didn't, and I had the reaction that I did.
Yeah, it do be like that sometimes.
It really do. For autistic bitches out here.
The thing that I love about this movie is that, well, I love a lot of things about this movie. I really, really enjoyed this movie.
I want to rewatch this movie because I feel like I am going to enjoy it a lot more a second time around.
Yeah, listen, let's watch it together.
Let's do it. Hell yeah.
I would love to. But one of the things that I really, really enjoyed in this movie is how not othering it is for its gay, queer, whatever you want to call them. The characters in this movie don't really label themselves. Mm-hmm. They're women who have sex with women, and some of them also have sex with men, and some of them don't. I think it's fair to say that Diane/Betty is pretty lesbian.
Yeah. They're queer. We can just use queer as an umbrella term.
Yeah.
Twitter isn't here to police us.
Exactly. But I think it's really kind of, I mean, especially for a movie made in 2001, I think it's really wild that it's so not othering for the queer characters.
Yeah, I agree. I actually was kind of expecting it to get like that, you know, as the movie went along. But no, it's very like, nope, these are just women having sex.
And like the thing that's wild to me too is that like even when it gets more kind of like outlandish and crazy, it's never like
the narrative never punishes its characters for being queer.
No, they're punished for like other parts of their personality that suck.
Exactly. Like they just happen to be queer. And it's not like there's no, it's not like one of those like old lesbian books, like the I don't know, there's a term for it, but
pulp.
I don't know.
Like lesbian pulp?
Yeah. Yes, thank you. It's not like lesbian pulp where like the characters have to be punished at the end so you know that being a lesbian is bad or that being queer is bad. It's just a facet of the story that exists and is largely unremarked upon.
So obviously Diane's relationship with Camilla in like the real world portions are like informed by the fact that they are queer, because Camilla kind of treats lesbian relationships, or relationships between women rather, as being like less important than her relationships with men.
R.I.P. Diane, you would have loved to see a side chick on the throne.
Yeah, like, you know, I hate you so much for that, by the way.
We disrespect Queen Lucy on this podcast.
So. Oh, that sucks. But, oh no, what was I saying? Obviously, their relationship is informed by the fact that they are queer, but, like, there is a version of this movie that exists in which Diane, like, is, like, sending a hitman after her shitty boyfriend. And like...
That would be a girl boss movie, sorry.
It would be treated narratively the same way that Diane is treated in this movie for sending a hitman after her ex-girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, for sure.
The fact that she is romantically involved with this other woman is not the reason why she is shitty.
Yeah, she's just shitty.
She's just a sad, lonely woman who happens to also be gay. And you know what? I love it for her. She's messy.
I'm also a sad, lonely woman who happens to be gay. I'm not that
messy
about it, though.
Gay bitches representation.
I'm not quite that messy about it, though.
Give it time. Eventually, we should all, like, get to that level of messy gay women.
It's always nice to have something to aspire to.
A role model for us.
Yes, truly.
I don't know. I just think it's really cool. And it's weird to say that.
It is. No, listen. 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 We need messy gay people in the media.
I just like that the messiness is not inherently tied to the gayness. They just happen to be messy and gay, as many of us are.
We need queer people who suck. That's the representation.
More queer people who suck. Also, I was expecting the gay stuff because, like, another thing that, you know, this movie has a reputation, obviously, for being very weird and mind trippy. It also has a reputation for being like, OMG, this is the movie with the lesbian sex scene like halfway through. It was not really even a sex scene.
No, they just kissed a bit.
They just kissed and like fondled each other's boobs, and then it cuts to them asleep.
Yeah, like, it's pretty tame in terms of sex scenes I've seen.
I was expecting some, like, blue is the warmest color bullshit to be happening on my screen, and that's not what happened at all. People were, I guess, so scandalized by this in 2001, which, like, yeah, I get it's 2001.
It was 2001.
But, like, I don't know. I guess my 2022 brain was expecting something a lot more graphic than what actually happened.
Yeah, it was just sort of, like, foreplay.
Yeah, they just like made out and then they like touch each other's boobs and then it was like that's it. And it's, I was really expecting to see like full-on scissoring or something. I was expecting to see scissoring and it wasn't. God. It didn't happen.
When will David Lynch put scissoring in his movies?
God damn it, David. Like, come on, listen, David. He's getting on in years. I need him to make a movie with scissoring in it.
Dave, we're waiting.
I saw this TikTok recently that, like, cracked me up, and it was this guy doing a David Lynch impression, and it was, like, David Lynch after directing some of the most erotic scenes ever put to camera, and it's just this guy doing a David Lynch impression. He goes, okay, that's great. We're gonna cut, and we're gonna do it again.
That's so fucking good.
I kept thinking about that TikTok when I was watching this movie, because I was like, yeah, that's definitely what it was like on set. Just like this really intense lesbian like scene, like foreplay, and then it's just like, cut. This jolly Midwestern man.
I will say, David Lynch has quite a reputation as being a director of what we at the Final Profiles call pervert movies. This one, not so much, I don't think.
No, that's, and again, it's weird because its reputation is lit. It's just like, it's, this is the horny lesbian movie.
This movie was shockingly not horny.
It's really not that horny.
And let me say, I was a little disappointed because, you know, I love me a pervert movie. But
I do love pervert cinema, but this really was not pervert cinema. You know, no. What's pervert cinema? Blue Velvet.
I have heard things about Blue Velvet.
Blue Velvet is such pervert shit.
I need to watch more David Lynch movies. I think this.
Me too. I'm realizing now, like, I've watched Twin Peaks, I've seen Blue Velvet, and now I've seen this, and that's really the only Lynch I've watched.
I've seen one episode of Twin Peaks.
I know of Dune.
Oh, I know of Dune.
I know of Dune. I don't know very much about it.
Friend of the pod, Jace, does love Dune, so.
Which, like I said, last episode, very, very on brand.
Yeah. Let's get back to Mulholland Drive.
Yeah.
I will say, watching this for the first time, I, like, fully bought into the whole conspiracy thing, and I thought it was going to be, like, a big, much bigger part of the overarching plot. I was like, oh, maybe Camilla Rhodes is a name they use to denote girls they're going to kill, or something like that, and she was Camilla Rhodes before she died. Or before she, like, she was the Camilla Rhodes of the next movie before she got, you know, in the accident that took her memory. Or,
yeah, when they were, like, they pulled over in the car and they were gonna kill her.
Yeah, I was fully into it. I had my little Pepe Sylvia corkboard up. I was fully into it, and then it turns out it's just Diane trying to justify why she's not getting roles.
It is very funny because, like, again, like, this was an element that, if it had become a TV show, would have been, like, actually, like, treated with a lot of weight. Mm-hmm. But instead, because the movie basically decides to do something completely different, and it's not a TV show, it is, in fact, a film, it is basically dropped.
Yep.
And becomes just this, like, side plot element.
It's very funny in hindsight.
It is very funny because it makes you guess, and then, oh no, this has nothing to do with anything, actually.
Literally. And, I mean, it's a fun little red herring for a little while, but also,
I do, like me, really think the director character cracks me up. He's very funny. Because, again, you think he's going to be way more important than he is.
Can I just say, my first note about the director is just, quote, oh no, not a twink named Adam,
unquote. You're having Saw flashbacks.
The worst Saw fandom flashbacks I've ever had in my life.
A twink named Adam. That's, like, the world's worst children's book.
It's actually the sequel to A Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh my, oh, that's an even better joke than the one I came up with. A twink named Adam. Yeah. A twink named God. Adam, who David Lynch has pointedly said is not based on himself.
Right.
Because apparently that actor did say, like, is this you? And he's like, no. Of course it's not. That's so funny. I don't know if he was lying or not.
That's so funny because I definitely had the thought of, like, oh, this is David Lynch's stand-in.
Yeah,
like,
apparently Justin Theroux also had that idea, and he literally asked David Lynch, and David Lynch was like, absolutely not. I don't know if he was lying or not.
his like his like Stephen King stand-in.
Yeah, neither does Justin Theroux. I don't know if Justin Theroux believed him or not either, but that's what he said.
Well, we'll take we'll give you the benefit of the doubt, Dave.
Yeah, I'd love how fucked up and like raw and shitty Naomi Watts is in the second part of this movie.
Yeah, it's great.
She's absolutely delightful as just a person who is just a complete and utter disaster, whose life is like falling apart at the seams.
Also, can I just say, Naomi Watts hot.
Naomi Watts hot. Laura Herring also hot.
Also very hot. There are a lot of very beautiful women in this movie. Like that, like, listen, that waitress, smoking.
You know what Roger Ebert said about Laura Herring?
What?
I forget the exact quote, but when he reviewed this movie, he said that Laura Herring, like, comes on screen for 2 seconds, and that those first 2 seconds of her being on screen are the best argument in 50 years for a Gilda remake, which is just, it's very funny to me, because it's like, Roger, you just thought she was hot.
Roger, you can just say she's hot. It's okay. You can just say it.
It's okay. She's a great actor, as she proves later on in the movie. It's just very funny to me. Like, okay, Roger. Yeah, I love women who suck. And Diane Selwyn is wonderful to add to my pantheon of female characters that I love, because they just suck and are awful.
They suck. I love it.
Like, yeah, man, sending a hitman out to kill your ex-girlfriend because she's getting married to some guy.
Yeah, man. Great. Great idea. Fantastic.
She tells you, yeah, we can't have sex anymore. I'm getting married to this guy. And Diane is like, okay, hitman time.
It's like, I could possibly move on and find someone else. Or I could hire a hitman to kill my ex.
And isn't that truly just a level of drama that we as gay people all aspire to?
We aspire to it, and also it is owed to us. We're allowed.
As John Mulaney once famously said, anybody who's seen my dick and met my parents needs to die. Diane took that very literally.
She was ahead of her time.
It's not enough to merely break up with your ex. You need to wipe them from the face of the planet. You need to have them killed.
You need eradicate them entirely.
Absolutely insane behavior. Like, I just love her so much. She's a mess. And also, just like, I mentioned this in my intro, but like, I truly, truly was shocked by that masturbation scene. That shocked me more than any of the sex in this movie, because it was very upsetting.
I remember being like, is she? No. I think she's just crying, right? And then the camera pans down.
And like, the camera panned down to her hand, and it's just like, oh no, Diane.
She honey. Is. She is.
Oh no, she is, isn't she? Oh, this poor woman. Just like sitting on her couch, just sadly masturbating at like 2 p.m.
Oh, not even, couldn't even wait. I couldn't even wait for a more respectable hour for masturbation.
No, you couldn't even wait till 2 a.m. like the rest of us.
Ugh.
Just fully masturbating in her house, just on her couch, in the broad light of day. Oh, crying her eyes out
in front of God and everyone.
In front of God and everyone. Oh my God. Yeah, absolute mess. I'm so also like interested in how Diane constructs the fantasy.
Me too.
And, like, what she chooses to change and what she doesn't choose to change.
What she romanticizes and what she does not. Can I just say really quick, just fun little fact. We can go back to the other thing earlier. I just don't want to forget this. The homeless man behind the diner, that is Bonnie Ahrens.
Yes! I was so excited when I learned this.
I was so happy. I was like, oh, that's definitely her. Like, she has a very distinctive face. I love her.
It's
I'm very
men.
Happy to see her.
I love you, Valak. I love you, Bonnie Ahrens.
I wasn't even scared of the homeless person, because I was like, oh, it's Bonnie Ahrens. I love her.
Yeah, it's impossible to be scared of Bonnie Ahrens. That's my friend from the television.
Anyway, as all of you know, those of you who knew me in both 2013 and now, I do have a little bit of a thing for characters with dream worlds. This is a little shout out to Osman Oswald and Wanda Maximoff, my beloveds. And I always think it's like so interesting to see artists' interpretations, especially on film, of like how the human psyche processes and uses like symbolism in their dreams, or, you know, quote unquote dreams. Sometimes neither of those examples I gave were actually dreams, but you know what I mean. Like, in these like places where we idealize ourselves and the life we lead.
Yeah, I love just like once it pulls out and you see the real Diane Selwyn's life, everything just sort of, and like elements from the earlier part of the movie begin popping up in the latter part of the movie. Like everything just begins to make so much more sense.
Yep.
It's like everything like clicks and you're like, oh my God. Yeah, I'd love the idea of just like her in her dream world wanting to be the one in control of the relationship.
Yep. She idealizes Camilla as still like cool and sexy and mysterious, but she's also a victim and vulnerable. And she relies on, you know, she lives in Betty's Rita lives in Betty's house. She only talks to her ever. She relies on her for everything because she's in this position where she doesn't know who she is. And I think another really interesting thing is that not only is Betty like the idealized version of Diane, but Diane's like personality and her things that she's dealing with are reflected in other characters in the story. Rita, I can't think of examples of one for Rita. Let me just cut that out. I think especially of the two guys in the diner who have explicitly a conversation about dreams and about like this homeless man who lives in the back of the diner. And I think one of the videos I watched posited that the homeless man was like a representation of failure and all these things that like Diane is terrified of. So to think that there's these two characters seemingly completely unrelated to the plot having a conversation about how this figure of Diane's fears is featured in one of their nightmares. It's like, oh, okay, cool. Normal times.
That is super interesting. I did not even think of that, like putting the homeless man scene in like the context of the rest of the movie. I don't know why. It's technically part of the dream fantasy, whatever the beginning bit of the movie is, but like that is so interesting. I love that.
Let me just quickly shout out the two videos that I watched after watching this movie that you may also want to watch after
yes,
you watch
please.
This movie. They're the first, if you just type in like Mulholland Drive explained, they're the first two that come up. One of them is by London City Girl and the other one is by The Take. And they both have some very interesting insight into what's going on.
I do not know very much about that other channel, but can confirm The Take is actually one of the few like ending explained type channels that is actually interested in like symbolism and analysis. And yeah. I really like them. So I have never seen The Take video about Mulholland Drive, but now that I've seen the movie, I definitely want to check it out.
You should. It was very, very interesting. Another example of that is the whole bit with like there's a whole bit with the hitman in the dream sequence or the dream world. And when you first see it, you think it's part of like the whole overarching conspiracy plot. But it's actually a position to kind of like, or, you know, this is the interpretation that was posited to me. It was sort of put there to illustrate how incompetent this hitman was, because Diane wants to place him in a position where he's incompetent. And maybe there is a hope that Camilla escaped and was able to like thwart him or whatever. It's actually a fucking hilarious sequence of this guy trying to like just murder this one dude to get info, and he ends up like killing three other people.
Oh yeah.
It's incredibly good.
Yeah, I almost have to wonder if that, like, assassination attempt was not, like, if there wasn't at the very least, like, a subconscious desire on Diane's part for it not to work. Because yeah, then she could be that person that she was in her dreams, and she could, you know, nurse Camilla back to health and be the person that she depended on.
Ooh, that's interesting. I think by the point that it happened, Camilla was already... No, actually, no, she wasn't. She wasn't, because we see Diane kind of wake up from the dream. And the, like, blue key is next to her bed or something, right?
Yeah. And that was what the hitman had told her, is when you see the blue key, yeah, you'll know that I did it.
Mm-hmm. So she was still... Okay, yeah, so she was still kind of dreaming. But yeah, that's interesting. I like that.
Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, considering the type of person that she is... It really is interesting to me, the, like, the way that she, it almost seems at times like she doesn't even really want Camilla.
No, she definitely just wants the idea of Camilla.
Yeah. She doesn't, Camilla as a person is awful.
Oh yeah, they're both
she,
terrible.
Like, she is mean and entitled, and she is, like, using Diane for sex and has no intention of actually pursuing a relationship with her, even though she knows Diane is, like, completely and utterly in love with her.
In fairness, if Camilla wanted to use me for sex and be mean to me, I would be okay with that.
That's true. Like, I would be grateful. Ripped to Diane, but I'm different.
Truly.
But sorry, we needed to be gay for a sec.
For those of us who aren't bottoms.
Yeah, I think...
Cut that out.
The problem... No, I think you've hit on something actually so huge-brained. And, like, what? The problem with this relationship is that Diane and Camilla are both tops.
Oh, so true. So true.
This is just... They both have... They need to be in control. They both are not right for each other, and so they were both tops.
I was gonna say, and so they were both tops.
Oh no. See, this is the thing that straight film critics don't understand.
Exactly.
This is a movie warning about the dangers of top-for-top relationships.
It's a cautionary tale.
I'm just joking, but oh my god.
No, but no, you're not.
But I'm not joking, I'm so serious.
I hate us. I hate this podcast.
I also hate us, but the thing is about it is that I'm right.
You are right, and that's why I hate it.
I'm so correct and real for that. what was I saying? I forgot what I was even saying. I just got distracted by them both being tops thing.
We were talking about romanticizing Camilla and how, yes, Camilla is also
a person. Yeah. But yeah, it's this whole thing where Diane does not even really want Camilla the person. Camilla happens to be the person who is giving her attention at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so she has projected a lot of loneliness onto her. And she wants her to be this perfect partner who will, like, depend on her. And, like, the thing about the sex scene that was really interesting to me is, like, by that point I had read the Wikipedia article, so I kind of knew what was going to happen.
Uh-huh.
And what was interesting about the sex scene in the beginning part of the movie to me, not the one in the real world part, but, you know, the there was only one bed scene.
Yep. I do have a note that says, and there was only one bed.
There was only one bed. When Betty said that to Rita, she was like, well, there's only one bed in the house. Why don't you just get in here and have a good night's sleep? I was like, there was only one bed. But
that's how you know we're both, like, terminally online.
Yeah, and yeah, we're both fanfic enjoyers, and that's why we were freaking out over that scene. But the thing that really struck me about that scene was how, like, I don't know how to describe it other than to say it was like the beginning of a porn.
Absolutely.
In that, like, it was just completely insane. Like, no human being would ever just, like, I have never had romantic inclinations towards this person. I am going to get in bed with this person completely in the nude.
Yeah.
Just cash. Like, that's the kind of shit that happens literally in porn. But, like, once you understand that scene in the context of it being Diane's fantasy, Mm-hmm. It makes total sense because porn is a fantasy. And of course, in this idealized version of her and Camilla's relationship, Camilla would just, like, you know, just casually get into bed naked with her because it's a sexual fantasy.
As you do.
As you do. Like, it's an unrealistic fantasy about having sex with this person.
Exactly.
So, of course, like, weird, nonsensical things happen to get to the point where they have sex. Because she just kind of wants to imagine having sex with Camilla.
Hey, while we're on the subject of weird, nonsensical things, Billy Ray Cyrus is in this movie.
Oh, we didn't even talk about Billy Ray Cyrus's cameo in this. That scene is fucking hilarious.
That scene is hysterical.
That scene is actually fucking delightful. And like, that's kind of when I knew that I loved this movie.
That and the Hitman scene are both just, like, hilarious, like, comedy of errors. It's great.
The way that this movie is, it so effortlessly goes from being, like, the scariest shit that you've ever seen in your life. Mm-hmm. Like, those two old people chasing Diane down that hallway.
Bad. Very bad. Horrible.
So fucking scary. Like, genuinely so horrific and evil to watch. I hated it. David Lynch knows the old people are terrifying. So he fucking gets it. But then also, like, you just have this hilarious scene of the director walking in on his wife having sex with the guy who, like, tends to their pool. And the guy is played by Billy Ray Cyrus for some reason.
And then, oh god, I love that he fucking grabs her jewelry, right? And he, like, puts the jewelry box on the ground and just starts pouring, like, pink paint all over it.
Yes! Because at first he's like, oh, I'm gonna shoot you. And then he's like, no, yeah. No, no.
No, 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 no.
I have something worse that I can do to you.
First we attack her heart.
First we attack her shiny things.
Oh, it's so, and she, like, fucking jumps on his back and it's just this whole, like, fucking chaotic scene.
To be her move, because when the mafia guys break into the house,
I mean, it was effective both times.
She also immediately jumps on his back.
I mean, it was like I said, it was effective both times. So
I respect the dedication. She's like a video game character. She's got one move.
You don't break a winning formula.
Exactly. Yeah, so fucking true, bestie. But yeah, that shit is hilarious. And, like, it doesn't take away from the rest of the movie at all.
Oh, no.
Because the movie is so
weird.
It's so bizarre that the weird comedy stuff does not feel out of place. Because, like, I've complained, I mean, friend of the pod, Elle, has heard me complain about this movie so many times. The original Last House on the Left is, to me, an example of a movie that tries to do what this movie does and fails at it.
I've never seen it, so I wouldn't know.
Listen, Last House on the Left is one of the only movies where I genuinely think that the remake is better than the original, and I will go down with that viewpoint. I invite anyone to fight me about it. But the original Last House on the Left, one of the things that really, because, like, it should be my shit. And it's so tonally wrong. It'll just cut to this other scene of these two, like, bumbling cops goofing around. And then back to, like, the most harrowing shit you've ever seen in your life. And it just doesn't work. And this movie, the way to make that kind of a tone dissonance work is to just have the rest of the movie be so bizarre and dreamlike that it makes sense for you to be bouncing around into these different genres.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why Mulholland Drive, to me, felt, even though it has these weird comedy scenes, like, it still felt completely like they fit with the rest of the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a way that something like Last House on the Left, again, I know you haven't seen it, but
I trust your judgment.
The comedy stuff just so doesn't land. It helps that the stuff in this movie is funny, and I don't find the comedy in Last House on the Left to be funny at all. It's like, doo-doo-doo, let's watch this woman's parents bake a cake and fuck it up.
Yeah, hilarious.
It's so funny. Anyway, back to her and her friend being raped and murdered in the woods. Like, cool, thank you for that, Wes Craven. Love that. But I think that Billy Ray Cyrus should cameo as a guy cuckolding a side character in every movie.
I agree wholeheartedly, especially every David Lynch movie.
I think that every movie should feature this scene.
I, for one, welcome this new addition to the Cuck Horror Cinematic Universe.
When you said to me, this is Cuck Horror, isn't it? And I literally, as you sent me that text message, I was already... I had Letterboxd open and I was adding it to the list.
Oh, I'm so happy about that.
I was literally in the midst of looking it up so that I could add it to the list of Cuck Horror films, which, by the way, my username on Letterboxd is Virgo Horror, and on my profile there is a list of horror movies which feature cuckoldry in them, and if you have suggestions, feel free to tweet them at us.
We should put it on the Twitter. Can we put it on the Twitter?
Yes.
Do it right after we finish recording.
I absolutely will. Yeah, feel free to tweet suggestions at us. We need more. I think Mulholland Drive was the 25th movie on the list.
We're always looking,
and maybe we'll cover it on the show. I feel like there's so much more that we could talk about, but I also kind of feel like we've hit on all the things that I personally wanted to discuss. Is there anything that you really wanted to
see? I was a silly goose, and I didn't take notes while I was listening to the Mulholland Drive Explain videos, which was most of where I got my opinions from, because, like I said, you know, mini mental breakdown at the end there. there's one. Oh, here, I'll just say this in parting. David Lynch loves his long red curtains.
Boy, does he ever. He loves his weird so red rooms.
And God, I love him for it.
I love him for it, man. He's like, David Lynch will make a piece of media. I was going to say a movie, but Twin Peaks. David Lynch will create a piece of media and be like, is anyone going to have a weird room with red curtains in it and not wait for an answer?
I actually have a real parting statement this time. And I realized this quarter of the way through this movie. And I had to text it to friend of the pod Meeks because it was very relevant to her interests. And you know what? I will just read what I messaged her. Hold on.
Meeks, by the way, who was our guest for our Suspiria episode.
Yes. So I'm just going to read. David Lynch and Dario Argento write dialogue in an extremely similar way. It's just that David Lynch does it on purpose to create a surreal atmosphere, and Dario Argento gives the impression that he just believes people talk like that in real life.
Oh my God, you are so correct!
And I think I just hit on, like, the answer to the universe there.
You are so correct. David Lynch writes dialogue like that because people talking weird is upsetting.
Yes.
And Dario Argento just does it because he thinks
that's how people talk in real life.
He just thinks that that's how human beings talk to each other. And it's like, Dario, they just don't.
Like, I'm sorry, Coco is a character straight out of a Dario Argento
movie. Oh my God, stop!
Like, within the first, like, 2 minutes of her being introduced, I was like, oh, she belongs in the Tons Academy.
Yeah, she's a lost Suspiria side character, for sure.
Who just wandered into a David Lynch movie.
Oh my God. I'm so obsessed with that.
I'm gonna leave it there, listeners.
That's so fucking funny. I'm dead. How are any of these Letterboxd reviews gonna compete with that?
They're not.
Speaking of which, I do a segment on this show that I like to call Live Laugh Letterboxd, where I shamelessly mine Letterboxd for content rather than coming up with funny things to say on my own. And here are some really funny reviews that I thought were, that they made me chuckle.
A hearty, some real knee slappers. As they
some
say.
Real knee slapper reviews. Frequent Live Laugh Letterboxd flyer Ian says, yeah, Ian. This is La La Land's evil twin.
So true.
Five stars.
This actually reminded me a lot more of a movie from, I want to say 2014, called Starry Eyes. And I think it was also kind of why I got, like, I couldn't quite put my finger on this movie, is because I was expecting it to be more like that, which is more about, like a satanic cult kind of thing.
That's why you latched onto the conspiracy stuff.
Exactly. I was like, oh, I know what this is. I know it is. It's a cult. And I know it's a cult. And it's not a cult.
It's not a cult. Although every movie would be better if it had a cult. And you can quote me on that.
That's true. And you should say it.
All movies would benefit from having a cult. It doesn't matter which one. Mary Poppins would have been better if she was a cult leader.
Oh, 100%.
Take notes, Disney.
Well, wait a minute. Do we know that Mary Poppins isn't a cult leader?
Maybe she recruits the children that she nannies.
We can't say this. Disney will hear us, and they will take this idea and make it bad.
Yeah, that's true. Although, no, I'm not going to get into my Mary Poppins opinions. Karsten says, understood all of this because I'm smart. Perfect movie. 5 stars.
Can't relate, Carson. Sorry.
Sarah says, MILF Holland Drive, 5 stars.
So fucking true, bestie.
And this leads into a point that I forgot to make when I was talking about how this was almost a television show, but I'm glad that I pulled this review because it made me really mad when I read about it. One of the reasons that the network turned down the pilot is because Naomi Watts and Laura Herring were apparently too old to lead a television show.
Oh my god.
Which is so beyond fucked.
That's real bad, guys.
Very upsetting to me because they are both in their early 30s.
That's real bad, guys. It's bad out here.
Yeah, it's bad out here. Anyway, they're hot. So fuck those people who said that. They're both hot. Lauren said, I very well know this is a live action film, but I feel like the director character should have been animated. 4.5 stars.
I agree so hard.
And like, I get it. I do. He should have been animated.
No, he shouldn't have, because if he was animated, he would be so close to Tumblr sexy man, like adjacent.
Oh no, why would you say something?
So, no, that's wrong.
Why would you ever say that with your mouth?
Because I am the devil's child.
Yeah, I hate it. Lily says, nobody, blank, David Lynch. And then we throw in some creepy old people.
He's so true and correct for that, though, is the thing.
And it's like, I get it, though, because old people, like I said, old people are scary.
Old people are so scary.
And David Lynch knows this, and so does M. Night Shyamalan.
Have y'all seen X? Like, old people are terrifying.
I haven't actually seen X. I also actually haven't seen The Visit. I don't know why that was my, like, point of reference for scary old people. I guess also, like, Rosemary's Baby.
X is a vastly better movie, so you should definitely watch that one first.
I definitely want to watch it. So this next review is a little long, but I wanted to read it in its entirety because it genuinely made me laugh, like, belly laugh out loud.
Go for it.
Okay. Kevin T. Porter says,
wait a minute. First off, love Kevin T. Porter. He's a podcaster.
Yes, he's a king. He posted this review on Letterboxd and it was so fucking funny. I belly laughed. It was really good.
I am an occasional listener of good Christian fun, so.
The first time I saw this movie was 18 years ago with my dad. I was 12 years old and a very active user on a message board called Home Theater Forum. I posted about wanting to watch this movie, but my parents would only let me if one of them was in the room with me. I knew there was some sex in the movie, so to avoid an uncomfortable experience, I made a post on the forum asking if someone could give me the time codes when the sex scenes happened, so I could not only fast forward, but fully skip those scenes by punching the numbers in. A nice man took the time to transcribe those time codes and DM them to me. I thanked him, and he replied, no problem, have fun watching the movie with your dad. And I did have fun watching with my dad. Happy Father's Day. When I tell you I read this review, I laughed so hard.
Why is that so funny?
If you were not around for, like, the early days of the internet, like, before the social media boom happened, I was a child when this happened, so, like, I don't completely understand, but, like, it was like that.
It was like that.
You couldn't have an interaction like that on Twitter.
As someone who is slightly older than Taylor and who does remember this era of the internet slightly, it was like that.
It was just like that.
It was a kinder place.
That is just, oh my god, the idea of this like grown adult man who sees this post by a 12-year-old being like, I want to watch Mulholland Drive with my dad, but I don't want to watch sex scenes because somebody sent me the time codes, and just fully transcribing the time codes.
What a king.
This man had to watch the movie. Oh my god.
What a fucking king. Like, thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Like, that man will never know the impact he had.
Culturally, on all of us.
Culturally, yeah, collectively. Anyway, the next review also made me laugh really hard. Lily says, the best part is when Betty asks Rita, a woman with very severe amnesia, if she's ever had sex with a woman before. Like, girl, how the fuck would she know?
Literally.
I did have that thought when I was watching that scene. She was like, have you ever done this before? And I was like, what?
Girl, she doesn't know.
She wouldn't remember if she did. She doesn't remember anything. Anyway. And the final review is from Cecile, who says, this is Fight Club for lesbians, 5 stars.
So fucking true.
Early 2000s movies about the perils of being a gay person in the world. Just like living as a gay person.
Living as a messy gay person.
Living as a messy gay person who has a lot of issues and lives for the drama. This is just Fight Club for lesbians.
Be a good double feature.
Oh my god, that would be... I have never actually watched Fight Club all the way through.
I haven't either, but...
Shocking nobody, it is one of my father's favorite movies.
In my heart, I know that this is a good double feature.
It's such a dad movie. Like...
Truly, it's up there with Top Gun.
Yes. Oh my god. Like The Godfather.
Oh my god.
Dad cinema is a real genre, and
it is a real genre, and the Oscars need to acknowledge it.
The Oscars need a best dad film category. And if you'll just follow me to the link in my Instagram bio to sign my petition to make the Academy recognize dad cinema as a genre.
If we get 10,000 signatures, Biden has to look at it.
Legally, they have to do it. They don't tell you this about petitions. Anyway, what's your star rating for this movie?
This movie, initially, I had it down as 3.5 on Letterboxd. I bumped it up to 4, and you know what? 4 stars. Good job, Dave. Like this one a lot.
Yeah, I'd say 4.5. It's not like... I feel like a 5-star movie, I've said this before and I'll say it again, has to be like... is for me. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this movie is for me. However, it is very good. So good.
It's very good. Just don't do what I did.
And it makes me want to watch more David Lynch movies.
I want to watch this one again, honestly. Like I said at the top, like, I want to have a positive experience watching this movie, and I feel like I would if I watched it again, because I get it now.
I haven't watched a David Lynch movie since I watched, like, Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet when I was in high school. I should probably watch Blue Velvet again, because I remember liking that one a lot. And Kyle MacLachlan is so baby in that movie.
Baby.
He's just a little guy. He's just a little scrunkly guy. And Isabella Rossellini is... I remember that was a formative gay experience for me. Isabella Rossellini in Blue Velvet, oh boy, that changed something for 16-year-old Taylor. I already knew I was gay at that point, but, like, that was one of the things that solidified it.
Yep.
I've like, oh, Blue Velvet, oh, Isabella Rossellini, huh? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Women.
Wow. I can imagine watching this movie at a tender age and having it change you.
Oh, God. This would, like, if you are a young teenage queer woman, this movie will shove your brain in a blender and hit puree.
Like, if this movie turned you into a woo woo sicko, please reach out to us. I'd love to hear your story.
We're forming a support group.
Yeah, exactly. For women for whom this made them into sickos. Anyway. What are we watching next time, Jemmy?
Oh, that's a great question, Taylor. Next time, we are watching 2021... Is it 2021? Fuck.
Hold yes, on. It is.
Okay. We were watching 2021's Last Night in Soho, another movie which also has kind of a fantasy reality kind of thing going on, and is about somewhat similar themes.
Duality and fame and...
Anya Taylor-Joy's in it, and she's hot.
No, so, my God, she's so pretty. I've never seen it. I'm very excited to see it. I've heard good things. I've heard Is For Me.
Taylor.
I have heard Is For Me, so I'm very excited to watch it.
Is For You. So we will see just how for you it is next time. And until then, you can follow us at FGFPod on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed what we did here today, you can give us those 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or do whatever it is you need to do on your podcast. Do whatever it is you need to do on your podcast platform of choice to let us know that you liked what we did here today. And we will see you next time for Last Night in Soho. Bye, guys.
Bye.